Think cocktails and you may think of vodka or whiskey, but you might also think of the word artistry and the idea that a great cocktail is a combination of flavor, balance, and presentation, not to mention precisely the right ice. That's right, ice. Today, a conversation about the art of the cocktail, just in time for this year's Paris of the Plains Cocktail Fest opening Friday. With us this morning, Doug Frost is back. He's a master of wine, a master of sommelier, and he's shaking things up right now. One of only a handful of people on the planet with those twin distinctions. Doug, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I just had to do a little shaking and handed it off to Ryan Miller, who's here from U.S. Bartenders Guild. And
Vice President of United States Bartenders Guild, Kansas City Chapter, don't you know?
Indeed, right? He is. And he's actually an extraordinaire. Those are going to be some serious cocktails. I think we should share those with some extra people.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should split those down because, we want our friends to get through all of these. This is the whole thing about a cocktail festival. If you don't know how to pace yourself, please don't be there. Yeah. I mean, if you have no self-control, it's not good to have you
not
there.
Where you
you're just
be.
In the way.
Yes.
You're just going to, bum everybody else out because we're out, out there to have a nice time.
This is serious business.
This is the origin of this was the Kansas City Bartenders Competition, which I helped create with Ryan Mabee of Manifesto and Rieger. Mm-hmm. And our thought was at the time that we felt like, there are really great bartenders here, and nobody knows about it. Nobody talks about it. Everybody talks about the coasts, and I felt like we had a lot of talent here, like guys like Ryan Miller and Berto Santoro and Scott Tipton and Jen Tassato and all these great people.
Right.
So we start this competition, and everybody gets excited, and frankly, the level of skill and professionalism and experience just kind of went through the roof as far as I'm concerned. So the next iteration was, let's start this festival and bring other people in from around the country so they can see what's going on and participate.
So what is a cocktail festival? What happens at a cocktail festival?
Shall we pass these out? Because this is the best answer. We get to drink things like this.
Yes, you're passing it over.
Yes, indeed. So
right now.
We haven't dressed these cocktails up super fancy, but the idea is for us, it's mostly focused on the trade. I mean, our feeling about this is that we're supposed to elevate people's impression of the professionalism, really, the bartending community in Kansas City. And we're supposed to help them elevate their craft. We're supposed to show them things and teach them things and let them learn and discover. So we don't do a ton of crazy parties, although there are, parties galore, of course, because you get bartenders thinking about what to do and they like, hey, let's do a party. But it's a lot of also learning about the basic materials that you work with, whether it's learning about sherry, because I'm going to be teaching a class.
I was going to ask you about, you're teaching a whole class on
sherry. Yeah, on sherry. And better than that is I've got Steve Olson coming in. And Steve Olson runs the sherry campaign for the United States and has for many years. And more than that, he's just one of these guys that's completely obsessed with sherry and has been for the 30 years that I've known him and worked with him. So we like to drill down into sherry, how different it is. And sherry's a fortified wine, just like vermouth is a fortified wine. And so the idea of using sherry in a cocktail is not that crazy. People have been doing it for decades.
I never thought about that before.
Yeah.
You pass out this first drink, and I'm joined in studio here by Brian Ellison, a host of Central Standard, interim host. Lisa Rodriguez, a reporter here at KCUR, was also the longtime associate producer of Up to Date. Have you had a taste of this new lemony thing?
I have had a taste of it.
This lemony.
Limey.
Well, limey, lemony, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Very close.
Yeah, it's all the same family. Yeah.
Yeah, it's delightful. It's really good and
cool.
It's
summer
it's
drink.
Refreshing, but it's also it's not expected. Either it's not a lemon vodka drink. It's unique, and I enjoy that.
Oh, Brian Ellison,
right. Very,
way in here.
Very much a summer drink. It's cool and refreshing. It's not sweet, which I like. I would not have liked it.
Things are always too sweet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But this I missed. If we talked about what the liquor is in it, I'm not able to discern it.
Well, what this is rum. This is a daiquiri of all things.
Wow.
But I actually had a piece in the paper today about my trip to Cuba, and I came back with an aromatic bitters that the Havana Club Distillery had created called Aromatic Leaf, and it's very clovey and The tradition there with daiquiris is just lime juice, a little bit of simple syrup, a whole lot of rum, and sometimes you'll throw some bitters on top of it. So I brought back this aromatic leaf bitters. I'm obsessed with the stuff. It just brings this whole new flavor, and you don't put very much in there, just enough that no one notices, but the drink becomes a bit more complex, dries it out a little bit. I mean,
yeah,
Ryan, what's your feeling about the role of bitters in general?
It's great. I always like to describe it as like your spice rack for your bar or your building a cocktail, a little salt, a little pepper, maybe a little aromatic leaf bitters to kind of deepen. And it brings out the flavors inside your modifiers and your spirits that you're already using.
So this is not hard to make. And what do you call this drink?
This is a daiquiri.
A daiquiri.
This is what daiquiris, instead of ring, on a blender, this is what a daiquiri is supposed to be. This is why people like daiquiris.
Let's not knock the frozen daiquiri.
Okay, I'm sorry.
This is not hard to make, though, is it?
No. Well, the only hard part about this is you can't get any of the ingredients in the United States. Well, I'm really helpful.
Might be a small hurdle.
Have to take a little field trip. I don't object to that.
Exactly. Cuba, here we come. Yeah,
I think so. I'm rather obsessed with Havana Club, the real Havana Club, the one in Cuba, and find its character to be a little funkier than most rums. Most rums, I think, follow the lead of the Bacardi style and in the Seinfeldian phrase. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's almost like vodka. It's so stripped down, and so when the reference was made to this isn't a vodka drink, that makes me happy because the rum has just a little bit of funkiness to it, and funky is a silly word to use, except. Great rums have a bit of funk to them. Mm-hmm. That there's something about sugarcane juice that gathers on kind of some people will talk about an animal smell, a vegetable smell, a flower smell, just smells that aren't just sugarcane. And there's the tiniest little whisper of that in this drink, just enough to make you go, huh.
Yeah.
There was almost an herbal quality that made me wonder if there was... Like a Saint Germain or some sort of other liqueur in there, but I love that that's actually just the rum and the bitters.
That's all it is. It's pretty amazing. We drank a fair share of these in Cuba.
Ryan Ellison knows what he's talking about here. This is interesting.
We brought
maybe
a professional
for the first time in the history of his time here at KCTR.
Right, exactly. Finally, we found my subject.
He's found his sweet spot. Here we go. Yeah. Can the public attend the Paris of the Plains?
Yes, absolutely. The Popfest KC. That's just our...
Paris of the Plains, that's the acronym.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we call it popfestkc.com is where people go for tickets. And anything is cool. You can go online, you can see what the schedule is and see what floats your boat. There's another seminar about fortified wines. There's a seminar about how people enter and win bartending competitions and even a seminar that talks about, the business of all this. But then we do a gin seminar and we're bringing in Tom Nichol, the guy who created Tanqueray 10, I think one of the greatest new spirits I've ever seen in my lifetime. Tom's coming in from Scotland and he'll explain how he did that. And we'll look at some other gins as well. I mean, Rieger gin, he helped make Rieger gin, which I think is a pretty remarkable new spirit as well. And then I've got a wonderful gentleman named Todd Richmond who's going to teach all about scotch and how old used sherry barrels are integral to scotch and how it adds to their flavor and brings aroma as well.
And there's this competition that'll take place here.
Yeah.
Who's competing and what's the fight over?
Yeah, we got to do that. It's the 10th annual Kansas City Bartenders Competition, if you will.
And
we
have 10th annual. Wow.
Yeah, so we have two people from outside the city and then four people from within the city. And
who are judging?
Who are the competitors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, it should be fun. The judges are some of the folks that are coming in from around town, from around the country. So I've got people like Steve Olson, again, Willie Shine, Andy Seymour, Sean Kenyon. Sean Kenyon is the brain behind Williams & Graham in Denver, the place, the really cool cocktail bar that kind of changed that. Andy Seymour is a New York based or New England based cocktail instructor, helps run a competition called World Class that's for the entire globe. And so just a cool group of guys. And then our locals are like Jen Tisato and Zach Snyder and Brock Schulte and Justin Richardson. So
Ryan, you're not competing.
No, I'm not.
You're skipping it this year.
Because you would have far cleaned, too busy.
You would have cleaned up.
Yes. Yeah, would have been a waste of time for everybody.
And what, these guys will the competitors will do what, Doug? What will happen?
Well, they've been asked to come up with three cocktails, and the cocktail every time we radically change the competition, and so this time it was okay. Give us an aperitif cocktail, and give us a dessert or a digestif kind of cocktail, and then give us a cocktail that goes with shrimp with remoulade. And so we'll serve up some shrimp with remoulade and see how it goes with shrimp with remoulade, which is seemingly a very simple food. But remoulade's kind of a interesting, you know, slightly spicy, very creamy kind of, you know, condiment.
So it's tricky.
Yeah, so it's definitely tricky. So we'll see how much they understand how food and cocktails interact. So that's part of the competition as well.
And the judges will be basing their determinations on what exactly? What's the challenge here
with
for
each cocktail? I think for all of us, there's a sense of purity that should happen with cocktails. I mean, I'd be curious how Ryan feels about this, but I feel like we went through an era when we dressed up cocktails like crazy. We had 20 different ingredients. We had, you know, I don't know, carpet bitters, you know, we had floor bitters, you know, wall, you know, it's like everything. I do my own bitters. I do my own glassware. You know, I make it while you watch. Sort of, it got ridiculous, you know, and people lost sight of the fact that it's just a drink. Just make me a drink. Don't take 20 minutes to do it.
Yeah.
So the drinks can't be too complicated, but there should be a real sense of purity that comes through. I want to taste the ingredients and know that they work together. And then we've got this other piece that says, you know, does it go with the shrimp? Now, I'm not going to be judging, but I know these judges really well, and that's what they're going to look for.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how do you feel about what works in a competition like this, Ryan?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I mean, you do need your because you can't always find what you need at your store, or if you need to preserve your cherries that you picked over the summer or whatever. But at the same time, there's something to be said about a daiquiri that you can make in a radio studio at 11 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
If it ain't broke. But you, like you said, you just add a little bit of bitters and you've elevated the cocktail like that.
Yeah. How difficult is it to judge a contest like this? I mean, is it hard?
It is. It's not difficult
because you're really
slicing. Well, you have to spit.
Things.
I mean, as a judge, you
can't.
You definitely
I was going to ask you. You don't swallow. You
spit. No, you can't. Although, of course, you know, if you find a really good one, you kind of whoops. I didn't mean to do that. But no, I mean, you really have to stay focused because you want to give every competitor an equal, space to do their best work. You don't want to immediately pick favorites. You really want to observe. So it's just kind of mental concentration is the only thing that gets in the way. People will say, "Oh my God, you know, after 15 cocktails, there's no way." It's like, well, you know. Professionals spit, one, and two, they understand the issue is concentration. You have to stay focused.
It's interesting to me that both Brian and Lisa, neither one of them chose to spit.
That is interesting.
Drinking.
Yeah. I just feel like that's demeaning to the quality of the liquor.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that one, Brian.
How seriously do the competitors take this competition?
Well, there's a $1,000 check at the end of it.
They want to win.
Yeah, so they want to win. And it's always bragging rights. I mean, this has been going on for 10 years, and it's just one of those things. For people in town, it's a great deal of fun to be able to say that you've been one of the winners. And for the people out of town, it's they view it, I think, more sort of pragmatically that they want to go. They want to make a name for themselves. They want to get some national press. They don't mind getting a $1,000 check as well.
Yeah. I should point out this is all taking place, the competition at the Brass on Baltimore,
Absolutely.
7 o'clock Friday evening. And to get tickets again, folks can just go to popfestkc.com.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're visiting this morning with Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, about the Paris of the Plains Festival opening up this weekend here in Kansas City. If you have questions about cocktails, how to make them, how to drink them, whatever. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What's this deal, Ryan, with ice and how the right kind of ice is critical for a good cocktail? Because I opened the show talking about that. I had never thought about ice as being a critical component, and you guys are saying, oh, yes, it is.
Yeah, you know, I'm not the authority on ice. That'd be my friend, Imbi Magazine, Bartender of the Year, Ryan Mabey, who actually, according to lore, local lore, invented ice. But
that's what they say.
There's definitely something to be said about ice, whether like you're making the cocktail or what ice you're serving the cocktail with. Some people prefer like a larger, denser cube that melts slowly that will keep your beverage cold but won't necessarily over-dilute it.
Ah.
Things like that. And you know, we use terms like hotel ice or Cheerio ice, the your kind of like lower quality, very wet ice, which sounds funny to describe ice as wet, but it can be wet.
And, but it melts quickly.
Yeah, it'll melt quickly. It will essentially affect the way that your cocktail is made. Because when you're shaking or stirring, you're chilling the cocktail, but you are also adding water to it. So if the ice is wet, then your cocktail will be, you know, maybe too watery.
Well, when you're making drinks then professionally, Ryan, do you have different kinds of ice on hand depending on the kind of drink you're making?
I've seen, you know, I work at several different bars and they all have different kinds of ice. For example, when I work
Each bar has multiple varieties of ice?
Depending on the bar, depending on what you're, like, for example, I work at the Rieger a couple days a week, and there is ice that we use for shaking and stirring. There is crushed ice for serving cocktails. And then, like I mentioned before, the larger cube that we use for more spirit-forward drinks.
Lisa Rodriguez is nodding her head. None of this is new to you. You knew all this about ice.
I've had my share of cocktails, and I've worked in my share of restaurants as well. And yeah, there are different different kinds of ice that are better in different drinks. You know, if you really enjoy a scotch, then and you don't want to water it down, then you want one of those ice cubes that is drier and that is more dense.
Yeah.
Or if you're someone who really likes scotch because the ice melts throughout and you like it at the beginning and at the end, then maybe that's what you want.
You know, I remember there was once upon a time I bartended back in the dark ages for, you know, very briefly. As my bartending friends will note, he is definitely not a bartender when they see me work. But
why not? Why is not Doug Frost a bartender?
Well, you know, you can only do so many things in this life. I'm trying to do them all, but I can't get them done. But
right.
No, I leave it to the professionals. I work within the industry and I do a lot of teaching and things like that. But when I bartended, I still remember there was a day that someone would say to you, I'll take another and keep the ice. Use the same ice.
Seasoned ice.
Exactly. The ice didn't melt. educate the ice. The idea was that the ice was so dense that we used back in the day before they invented these machines that banged out ice in 30 minutes and that melts as soon as you look at it. You could drop a cube in a glass and pour somebody a whiskey and come back 30 minutes later and they go, no, just on top of the ice that's still there. Mm-hmm. So it's a different world. And in a way, what we're trying to do is return to the way it was before we came up with the efficiencies of these super fast ice machines that you can snap apart with your fingers.
I think there's also something really classy about certain ice in the glass. You know, when you get this one big cube of ice in the glass or a round ball of ice, it's just sort of fun. It makes the drink look more fun. What I've really been interested in is the ice that's actually infused with something like smoke. I've had that at a couple local places.
Ah, and some people, I should point out there listening, are going to be thinking right now, you guys are going way too far with this whole thing if you're talking about the quality of the ice. But Doug, it matters. It's bottom line, it matters.
I think it does. Exactly as Ryan said, if the ice is too wet, it just breaks apart. And you're trying to chill the drink, but you're not trying not to over dilute it. I mean, you are trying to dilute it to a degree because in general, you want to, if you're stirring or shaking, you're still trying to break the alcohol down about 20% or so, maybe 25%. In the old days, I mean, we believe the origin of the cocktail is this thing called punch, and punch is still around, but we also believe that it's based on this this notion or this habit the British soldiers had in India of making this thing called punch. And the reason we believe it was called punch is ek, do, se, chahar, punch. Those are your Farsi words for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it had five ingredients, and they were basically your booze, and then you had to have, you know, something sweet, something sour, something spicy. In our case, we use bitters, but back then you might use nutmeg or clove or something. And then you had to have your weak, which is water. They would add water. Today, that's our ice. So you want to dilute your drinks. There's no question about that, but not too much. And you want to get them ice cold, because I think that's the sort of the American genius at work. We're the ones that really invented commercial ice, and the ones that in many ways invented the modern cocktail. And to me, a crucial ingredient is that you make it ice cold so people can be refreshed.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Bob from Leawood. Bob, you're on Up to Date with Doug Frost. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. We received a liqueur called Safari, and I don't know if it was brought in legally or illegally, but I know it was from out of the country. We have not been able to locate any more of it. are there regulations limiting what can be imported into the United States in terms of liqueur? I know wine can be brought in, but what about liqueurs?
Yeah, there are absolute limitations. Customs typically will try to, you know, stop you at three bottles or a bottle and a half or something like that, depending upon the proof. Customs is also fairly mellow about that. But you start bringing in, you know, more than three bottles, you're gonna get their attention, and you may even have more trouble than that. So yeah, our government tries very much to limit people's ability to move alcohol. It's actually, in fact, illegal for us to move alcohol across a state line. As crazy as that sounds, I wouldn't want to admit that I live in Kansas and I brought this stuff from Kansas into Missouri. But oh my God, I've just admitted to a crime. It's kind of silly. And in fact, you know, bringing in my aromatic leaf bitters from Cuba was not something that I'm supposed to do. So, you know, you don't flaunt it, that's for sure. But it's our alcohol regulations are arcane. And they're different state to state. We have 50 different countries when it comes to alcohol beverage law. But I would say in general, what you did, you were not supposed to do, but they don't, you know, they're not going to freak out over a single bottle of liqueur.
Well, all right. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. This hour, we're talking cocktails with Master of Wine, Master Sommelier Doug Frost. Ryan Miller is also here. He's a local bartender, vice president of the United States Bartenders Guild here in Kansas City. Here in the studio with me also, Brian Ellison and Lisa Rodriguez, both from KCUR. And since we last talked on the air live, you brought us another cocktail. Ryan, what is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of like a take on a Tom Collins. We use Doug's favorite gin, Tanqueray No. 10. Some sugar, lemon juice, and then instead of club soda, I topped it with the Boulevard Lemon Ginger Rattler.
Oh, that's what that is. Yeah. Dr. Ellison? Reverend?
Reverend for the liquor tasting show, yes. This is excellent. This is really fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much.
That ginger...
It's two for two, I think.
The ginger lemon rattler really... really
rattles
adds,
it. It rattles
yeah,
it.
It shakes it up. It's not just a lemon drink anymore. Yeah. I really like it.
Yeah.
Lisa?
It's like if a Tom Collins and a summer brew came together and had a cocktail, this would be it. And it's delicious. I mean, I like to taste my booze a little more in a cocktail, and so I might choose the daiquiri from last round, but it's really good.
All right.
I think the world is should be mixed up with lighter cocktails, mm-hmm. and boozier cocktails. I mean, we certainly try to do that when I'm, you know, helping somebody with their cocktail list. It's always a lot of bartenders tend towards the boozy side because they love to taste their you know, their spirits. And it's like, yeah, but a lot of us need long cocktails. And by long, I mean things that you can drink that won't get you too inebriated. And in fact, I think one of the really important things that I always want to send that message out there to any bartender that's listening, you have to have great non-alcoholic drinks. All of us, even those of us who drink, at some point we'll say, hey, can we slow it down here? And there's only so much water I can drink. I'd love it. I love it when people give me a really flavorful drink that has almost no alcohol in it at all. And I can drink that and feel safer.
I'm getting some questions about ice, believe it or not, Doug. Greg Maupin's asks on Twitter, so how does one make the dense ice? I have the devices to freeze them, but tap water doesn't seem to work, Ryan.
I really like you can purchase silicone molds on the internet.
The interwebs?
Yes.
They have it there?
And they have different shapes and sizes that you can use for that, anywhere from like a 2x2x2 to a longer cube, like for a Collins, like in a taller glass.
Huh. And that works pretty well, you're saying?
Works well. Seen it at almost every bar where I've worked.
Does it matter if you use tap water or like a distilled water or?
I guess that's just based on your preference. I mean, if you have tainted water, then you're going to have tainted ice.
Okay.
Some people like to use distilled water or purified water. Some people will boil their water and then freeze it from there.
Really?
And then people will get obsessed with like the clarity of the cube and the way that water freezes. I've seen incredible devices, homemade or commercial, but the way ice freezes from top to bottom, and the slower the freeze, the clarity of the ice will be clearer.
Well, you're answering Julia Williamson's question via Twitter. How can you make nice, clear ice at home, make large, round ice balls, but they are not she can make large, clear ice balls, but they're not crystal clear like you get from a bar. That's what you're talking about.
Right. So, like I said, I would again, referencing the internet, YouTube is a great resource for learning how to do anything bartending related, typically. There are videos of people making ice as clear as they can, or there's even, you know, commercial ice production is a thing. Or yeah. Some bars, like in larger markets, will hire people to just make ice for them.
Wow. Sam from Kearney, Missouri, has a similar question. Sam, good morning.
Hello.
Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, I went to a local franchise restaurant, Jack Stack's, and I ordered a raspberry sangria. And I said, give me very little ice. And I think they thought I said, give me extra ice, because what I got was hardly, I mean, they filled the glass with these chunk ice cubes clear up to the top, and then put the sangria, not enough for two gulps. Now, could I order my cocktail in one glass and my ice in the other? Is that cheating?
That's interesting. Can you do that?
I think so. You know, my attitude will always be about the restaurant business, that if you're not satisfied with something, you tell them. And if they're a real restaurant, and Jack Stack certainly is. I mean, those people, I think they seem to me well-trained, will immediately go, we're really sorry, we'll fix it, no problem. Mm-hmm. You know, that's their role. That's what they're supposed to do. So if you ever have a problem, if a drink doesn't taste right, you don't like the way it was presented, to me, you just say, I'm really sorry, but could you take this back? And I would like one this time with two cubes, which is kind of the European style. You know, the Europeans still are sort of mystified by our obsession with ice. I can't tell you the number of times that I've had a cocktail and I look at it and there's one cube there and it's not very big. And I'll say, could I have just a little more ice? And they'll sort of look at me like, these Americans, and they'll take their tongs out and they'll pick up one cube and drop it in my glass and then look at me like, yeah.
Is that enough?
Are we done here?
Yeah. You know?
Well, you're getting your money's worth when you don't have a lot of ice, because a cocktail, I mean, if I'd have separated my ice from my cocktail, I really doubt if I'd have had two jiggers full of sangria. And I mean, when you get sangria, you get some sangria. With some sangria, that's part of it.
Yes, sir.
It's not like you're drinking a potent.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Yeah, I would just, you know, when something like that happens, politeness, but you have a right to get the drink that you wanted.
Brian, Lisa, do you guys ever send drinks back? Have you been known to say, this isn't quite what I expected or wanted?
Maybe every once in a while. It's not something I'm usually
having.
I'm generally very pleased with whatever is
that
served
discerning.
To me.
As long as it's boozy enough, according to what we've heard.
Yes, yeah. Brian, do you?
I on a very rare occasion, but only when I feel like it's different than what was described to me. You know, mm-hmm. There are, but often I'll drink it anyway, because I'm sort of open to these new experiences. I like a cocktail that I have not had before, frankly. If I've gone to the trouble of ordering a cocktail rather than a shot of bourbon that I know already, I'm open to a new experience. You're not going to like everyone equally.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. I had an experience two nights ago. I was in St. Louis at a fantastic restaurant. I loved this place called Reed's American Table. And we ordered a very old Bordeaux and we poured it, we decanted it and we poured it into glasses. And we all marveled about how the wine changed and how great it was at times, and then it sort of tightened up. It was like almost a 30-year-old Bordeaux. So quite a special thing. But one of our friends said, I don't know what you guys are so excited about. I think this wine's shot. And it was just like, wow, Sally, that's kind of harsh, you know, but okay. And we sort of scratched our heads. And then right at the end of it, we'd finished our wine and she still had her glass. And I was like, if you're not going to have that. And she said, I don't know what you guys see in this wine. I picked it up and her glass was dirty. So it ruined the wine.
Oh.
And it was like a totally different wine. I was like, well, no, why didn't you say anything? She was like, I thought the wine was bad. It didn't even occur to me.
Yeah.
So it is possible. You know, restaurants are serving a lot of different things. Something can happen. And it's nobody's fault per se. It's just one of those things. I think there's nothing wrong with saying, doesn't seem to taste right.
That happens a lot at Lisa's house. The glasses are dirty and then the wine is spoiled. I've noticed that time and time again. Why is that, Lisa?
There's just so much work to be done. I can't keep track
she
of all of it.
She devotes all her time to KCUR, Steve.
Yeah. Michael Hagen asked via email, can the guest comment on St. Germain, the elder flower liqueur? What uses do they have for it? Ryan, is that ringing a bell for you?
Oh, yeah. I love that stuff.
What uses do you have for it?
I think it's great as a sweetener. Like, you could even replace sugar with it to give your cocktail a more herbaceous or floral note.
I like
it with gin.
Oh,
sparkling
wine. It's really lovely with
gin. It works well with the yellow chartreuse, I find.
Different or maybe grape citrus juices like grapefruit juice and Saint Germain seem to
absolutely
be magical to me.
Yeah. You know, you can put that stuff in anything. A lot of bartenders refer to it as their ketchup.
Mm. Okay. And I should point out, Susan from Leawood, I love our listeners, said she found silicone molds for ice cubes. Are you ready? At the Auric Vacuum Cleaner Store in Overland Park. Susan, you're a gem, and I appreciate you writing in with that. Vince from Waldo asks, where did the term cocktail come from?
Oh, here we go. Now, this is a rabbit hole that we can... There are many theories, including involving, you know, Martha Washington put the tail of a rooster into a drink to disrespect the British soldiers. And, you know, yada, yada. We have the cacuto, which the cocte... New Orleans supposedly invented it, which it didn't, but it was based upon this small drink that you could find that was... called a cocktail, and the theory that this week holds, maybe next week will be replaced, is that the cocktail was a slang term for a mixed breed horse, and follow me.
Of course, it was.
With me on this one.
Yeah.
The Bittered Sling was something that became popular in the Hudson Valley, where horse racing was very, very popular in the early 19th century. And so we think that a cocktail was something that they would refer to when you put different things together, mixed breed horse, and in this case, a Bittered Sling. You would take sugar and you would take booze, which was seen to be good for you, and then you would add bitters to it, which was also medicinal. So now when you put sugar and booze and bitters together, you can see the beginnings of a cocktail there. And so the first time we see it in print, it's 1806, I believe, and it's in the Hudson Valley Register, and it refers to a thing called a cocktail, which we call a Bittered Sling. And so it was this sugar, booze, and bitters. Now, that's the first record we have, although there's a something I came up with in Japan, of all places, referring to something a Portuguese doctor created, and it happens about the same time, and he too called it a cocktail, so it's hard to say.
Well, clearly the term cocktail stuck and the sling thing just didn't work.
Yeah.
Ryan, do you know all that? You work in this business.
Oh, absolutely. I knew all that.
Okay, good. That's exactly the right answer.
Hudson
Ken
Valley
from Lee Summit. Ken,
absolutely.
You're on Up to Date. Our number 816-235-2888. Ken, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the show. Great, knowledgeable guest. Have they ever heard of a liqueur I used to drink quite regularly? It seemed to have disappeared off the planet. Called Sciarada, an Italian green liqueur, traditionally drank in a shot glass with a maraschino cherry dropped in the bottom of it.
Where in heaven's name do you... I mean, I remember that, but it's like, wow, that's one from the past. Do you remember that one at all, Ryan?
I think a little before my time, Doug.
Oh, sorry. I'm showing my age. Yeah, you know, that's one of those... I haven't heard that name in probably 30 years. I would have to go hunting on that one. But yeah, that exists. You know, the thing I will say is that if I recall it correctly, I don't know where in Italy it came from, but the thing about the Italians is especially in central Italy, but in other areas as well in the north, every town has its own bitters. It's kind of crazy. I mean, they all make their own bitters and they put their stuff together. And typically the name of the bitters is just the name of the town or, you know, the name that the town used to have. And so Sciarada, I can't remember where in Italy it came from, but I'm pretty sure it was actually the name of the town, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that. For the record, I Googled it, and the closest I've come are empty bottles for sale on the internet for $200 to $400 of it. That's
Whoa.
All. No liquor in it, just empty ones. Not even a full one left on the shelf from 40 years ago. But thanks for your answer. I'll listen to the rest of the radio show. Bye, guys.
Yeah, Ken, thanks very much. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about cocktails with Doug Frost and Ryan Miller, just in time for the Paris of the Plains Cocktail Festival opening up this weekend. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Michael from Raytown. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, what is a sidecar? What's its origin, and are there any variations on it?
What's a sidecar, Ryan?
So a sidecar is probably one of the more original daisy cocktails. It's brandy base, and then for sweet, you use an orange liqueur, and for sour, it's citrus. In the sidecar, it is lemon juice, and traditionally served with a sugared rim. Plenty of variations on it, probably the most popular being the margarita, which is tequila, and then the orange liqueur with lime juice instead, and then salt instead of sugar.
And when people try to figure out the origin of the margarita, remember that daisy is margarita in Spanish.
Okay.
Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I appreciate that very much. What's the deal? I mentioned it at the break that you're giving a seminar talking about how oxygen, of all things, is a fundamental tool in the distiller's art. Oxygen, Doug?
Well, the...
Whatever happened to alcohol?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's certainly that. Well, yeah. The thing is what people often forget, and I think some of the younger distillers don't recognize this either, that you put whiskey inside a barrel, let's say, or rum in particular, whatever, but let's say whiskey or brandy, and you put it inside a barrel, and the barrel obviously brings flavor and changes the texture and such. But what they often fail to recognize is how that flavor and those aromas and textures change over time. And so we have, for instance, rum producers who are keen to age their rum barrels at a certain elevation. So it stays colder up there and the temperature changes are more dramatic than if it were down at sea level where it just stay hot and humid the whole time. Whiskey right. producers who believe that having their barrels aged next to the ocean gives it a more salty, more briny aroma. So, you know, environment where the barrel is makes a difference. And what that's reflecting is that oxygen is getting to this whiskey or this brandy or this rum, and it's making its changes. So time in barrel is just as important as the barrel itself.
The other thing I want to ask, and Ryan, I might come to you on this, that one of the sessions at the Paris of the Plains Fest is going to deal with how to enter and win bartending competitions. Is there a secret to it?
If there is, I haven't quite figured it out yet. I've entered many. I've advanced a few times, but never actually taken home the gold.
Mm-hmm.
But I am excited for that. Doug mentioned the world-class competition earlier, and speaking at that would be the winner from, what was that, 2014
yeah.
that he won? The Charles Jolie won the entire global competition. So I'll definitely, if I can find some time, be sitting in on that one.
Okay. Any tips on how to win one?
Well, it really comes down to you've got to make something that's impressive. Certainly, you have to make something that's outside the box. But there still, to me, has to be this purity of flavor. It glows when it comes together. It's you know, we talk in the wine business so often how certain foods and wines, you put them together and something magical happens. That's essentially what we're asking the bartender to do in a competition. Find this magical, perfect balance, and new flavors seem to arise. And so as a judge, that's what you look for.
We have a third drink sitting in front of us now, and it is a little stronger than the other two. Lisa, you said you wanted to taste your liquor in your drink, and
yeah, just
you've
for
got
you, Lisa.
This.
And I do.
And what's striking about this one is before you even taste it, it just hits you in the face, the aroma of it.
It's whiskey, right?
I believe
bourbon,
so.
It's bourbon, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It is bourbon whiskey, aged 8 years.
And it's delightful. It's got a nice, like, almost a candy smell to it when you start. But then it kind of lingers for a while. And so, I mean, it is boozy, but I think I'd sit and drink this for a really long time. I'd enjoy a sip at a time and have some food or chat with friends. So it's not like I want it boozy for the immediate effect. It's going to last me a while.
Brian?
There's a sweetness to it, but it's not a sugary sweet. It's not treacly.
You guys really stay away from the too sweet stuff, don't you?
I hate the too sweet stuff.
There you go.
I mean, this is a good brown good liquor drink. It is boozy, and you would not want 4 or 5 of these,
no,
like you might.
Couldn't do that.
The drinks.
I've seen it done.
Well, it can be done, but you know,
over a long period.
I would
of time.
Refer to those earlier drinks we had as sort of dangerous because you could drink about 10 of them before you realized you were. I shouldn't be doing this. This one, like you know, you're getting a cocktail, and it's tasty. It's really very good.
Tell us about it. What is it, Ryan?
This is a new classic cocktail called the Pendergast. So Doug mentioned earlier spirit, bitters, sugar, and that's basically what we have here. So the spirit being bourbon, and the sweet or sugar part is sweet vermouth, a fortified wine, and Benedictine, an herbal liqueur, sweetened. It's got like honey notes and things to it. And then bitter, everyone's favorite, Angostura, aromatic bitters.
Yeah. Okay, this has been great. You know, it's funny, Brian, a show like this tends to go a little faster than the typical show. Why is that?
I don't know.
What happened?
I really liked guest hosting when Doug Frost was here. Steve, if you ever need to be away on this day.
That's not going to happen. Don't hold your breath for that. I want to thank Doug Frost once again, master of wine, master sommelier. And what's this where you're bringing us here?
So we have a little copita, a little clay cup filled with, with a little bit of mezcal in it. Mezcal is... for a lot of people, it's a scary drink, but it's not. It's almost a spiritual drink. It is made from the maguey or the agave plant. It's distilled certainly, and this is just straight but it's roasted. Those agave hearts are roasted in the ground, and it gives it more of a smoky flavor, but also a richness. And this is a single variety plant called Arqueño. And we'll talk about mezcal at a luncheon on Friday with Steve Olson
as well.
That's
great. Pairs of the Plains coming up this weekend. The website, again, to get more information, popfestkc.com. I want to thank Ryan Miller once again for coming in. Ryan, you were great.
Thank you.
So much.
Pleasure.
Yeah.